listening to the Yacht Racing Life podcast, the show for racing sailors everywhere, featuring exclusive stories and interviews from across the world of competitive sailing, hosted by British sailing journalist Justin Chisholm, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back. This time, my guest is Irish solo offshore skipper Tom Dolan, who in the summer of 2024 joined an exclusive club when he became only the third non-French sailor to win the hallowed Solitaire du Figaro Regatta. His achievement is all the more impressive given that he didn't come from a sailing family or even grow up close to the sea. In fact, Tom was brought up on a farm in the middle of Ireland, and his first sailing experience was on a shallow lake aboard a battered old wooden dinghy on which he and his father taught themselves to sail. An inauspicious start to a professional sailing career, perhaps, but Tom had been well and truly bitten by the sailing bug. Despite studying agricultural science at college, he soon felt the pull of the sea, and that led him to a bold move to Concarneau in northern France, the epicentre of the French offshore racing scene. After teaching himself French and cutting his teeth in the mini class, he moved up onto the Figaro circuit, where he set his sights on one day lifting the Solitaire du Figaro trophy. I caught up with Tom to find out the full story of his auspicious victory. So, Tom, I wanted to begin by talking about your early life. I know you grew up kind of in the middle of Ireland on a farm, I believe. That doesn't seem like the perfect route for a career in offshore sailing.
No, it wasn't. I definitely wasn't destined to become an offshore sailor. No, yeah, I grew up in the northeast of Ireland, County Meath, just about an hour and a half north of Dublin, not far from the border with Northern Ireland. And I did indeed grow up on a farm. But where we are, there's lots of lakes.
Now that's familiar to me because I grew up in the northwest of England and we didn't sail on the sea. We sailed on the gravel pits and the lakes and the puddles, as our southern friends used to call them. Was it the same for you?
Yeah, and they say there's, you know, it's one of these places where they say there's 365 lakes, you know, there's one for every day of the year.
So where did the desire to go sailing come from? A sailing family?
Or? No, not really. My father had done a bit at one stage and I can't remember exactly why. I was young. I was only 8 or 9. And he just got an idea, got a notion. I don't know, I used to always watch pirate movies and stuff like that. And the Volvo Ocean Race used to be on an Irish language TV program once a week. And it was dubbed in Irish, of all things. And we used to watch that as well. And he used to just explain to me about how it worked and stuff like that. And I don't know, he just got an idea once and decided to buy a little wooden dinghy. It was a Marauder, it was called.
Marauder, yeah. That was part of the Mirror family, wasn't it?
It was like a mirror with a bow.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember that class.
But I don't know, yes, we used to take it out on the lake down the road and just float around. You know, it was a fairly banged up little boat. You know, when ropes were missing, we'd replace them with baling twine and stuff like that. So it wasn't exactly beaten through the high seas. And it was a real shallow lake. You could actually, in the winter when it freeze, you could walk cattle across it. So, and it was probably safe because if you fell out, you could stand up.
That's an amazing start. So no formal training? You just kind of taught yourselves how to sail?
Yeah, more or less. I don't think we were very good, you know, looking back on it. I don't remember being spinnakers or anything. So as you said, I have no formal training because especially where I'm from, you know, we're born and bred with our own national sport, which is football. I don't know, it's Irish football. You might have seen it before.
Yeah.
Any other kind of sport was kind of hard to get a space for it. Especially if I try and tell my friends, doing the sailing thing, you know, it sounds really cool. They'd look at me like it was like a tree eyes, and what are you on about? But kind of fell away. It was like my little hidden secret. Until I was in my late teens, and I actually went to college. I did agricultural science of all things, and I dropped out of college, and found this course where you could go and learn and become a instructor, a management course where you could do all these kind of outdoor sports things, which I went and did. And as part of that, you had to work experience. They suggested I go to a place in the south of Ireland called the Glenans, the Glenon, which was actually a base that had been set up by the French Sailing Association, which still exists and probably is the biggest sailing school in Europe. That's really how I got into it big time because, you know, sailing isn't even, plus the fact that I came from the country far from the sea. And anyway, sailing and any sort of competitive sailing in Ireland is more or less restricted to around, or was then, I don't really know anymore, but was then restricted to around the big cities and the private yacht clubs, you know, that were, first of all, expensive to get into. And even if you had the money to get into them, were hard to get into because someone had to, you have to know someone who'd second you, and there was all this kind of sponsoring thing. So like, there wasn't even a question in my mind to go and do that. Until I found this Glenon place, which was a non-profit organization. I remember the first time when I got down there, they were like giving me a tour of the base, and I walked into the workshop, and there was this dude with like dreadlocks down to his arse, like a rolled up cigarette hanging out of his mouth, you know, using an angle grinder, you know, with no guard on it and a pair of flip flops.
So how long did you spend there?
In the base in Baltimore, I think I spent about 3 or 4 years. Until they offered, they said to me, "What do you think? Would you like to go and train in Brittany in Concarneau?" And by then I'd kind of become more and more interested in racing. I'd done some racing in Cork and in Kinsale, like, you know, just showing up in a pontoon and going to boats and going, "Here, any chance I can come out with you?"
To that point of the elitist nature of sailing and yacht clubs, and people often say to me, "Oh, you know, sailing's a millionaire sport," and it is. It's such a broad range. It is at the top end. But when I started sailing, I did exactly that. I turned up at a sailing club and said, "I'm available." And you know, I was never really short of opportunities to go sailing, and it cost me virtually nothing.
Yeah, it was a great way to get into it. To find, I've actually got refused sometimes. People would say, "No, it's a private club. Sorry, you know." So it was a bit hard, and I think that's why I kind of got so attracted by the French side of things, because they were so open and they were so. I remember there was one of them was like showing me videos on YouTube. YouTube only showed up, and it was this video of a Figaro, you know, this fella on his own in the boat, say, the screaming down waves, you know, the one of those helicopter images. And I was kind of thinking, "Whoa, that's like the ocean race thing I used to watch when I was small, you know." And then he was there. "Oh, yeah. When I go back to France, I'm going to work on one of them. I'm going to be delivering one that." Like, preparator or whatever. It just made the whole thing seem so accessible, you know.
Yeah, you made the move to the Glenan base in France, which was whereabouts was that?
Concarneau.
Okay, which is where you're talking to me from today. So have you been based there ever since?
Ever since, yeah, 12 years. It's a good place because it's right in the middle of what they call the Sailing Valley between Lorient, Port-au-Forêt, and it's kind of the place to be when it comes to offshore, all things offshore racing at the moment. I'd figured that out back then. To be honest, I didn't have high hopes of doing any racing. You know, I went and I said I just wanted to learn more about sailing. I liked the way the French did things. They were very open and welcoming to me, and I saw a kind of path way into the French world of sailing. I was fairly good at fixing things. I could probably get a job as a shore crew on one of these boats, and maybe someday a Volvo boat, etc. And I kind of realized that France was kind of the place to be when it came to that.
Did you speak any French at that point?
No, I did German at school. Oh, it was hard. But I was lucky because I was completely immersed. I was doing a professional training certificate to become a French instructor. It's the Brevet d'état, it's called. It's like a 9-month long training program. So I was completely immersed in all day, every day, French. So after 5 months, it was strange. People told me after 4 months it could click, and it took me 5 months. I actually booked flights home at one stage because it was just so hard.
That's amazing to hear. Doing the research for this call, I saw you being interviewed on the boat speaking what sounded to me like fluent French and maybe a hint of an Irish accent in there.
You have to keep the Irish accent. It gets you out of trouble a lot. The tax man and banks.
Exactly. But you're fluent now in French.
Yeah, I live in French. My fiance is French.
Fantastic. So when you made that move over to France, what sort of age were you at that point?
I would have been about 23, I think.
That's a big move, isn't it? That's a big move to leave your home country. And I know it's not too far to go to France, but do you remember it being a big move?
Yeah, it was a bit. Be honest, Ireland, it was also, there was a big recession in Ireland at that time. And the Glenan base where I'd been working had closed down. All my friends of my age were leaving. We're going to America and going to Australia. So it was not really going on at home. And to be honest, I was young, free and single. I had nothing I wanted to do. And all I wanted to do was sail, learn more about sailing and get into sailing. Like that. The language was a big thing, I suppose.
So to draw the line, join the dots for me now between that move
getting that qualification, learning French, to starting to race formally? Because I know you were involved in the mini class at one point.
So I was working for the Glen Ullin. I was 2011 or 12, and for the next couple of years I worked for Glen Ullin. And in the meantime, my time off, I started doing a bit of racing on the mini circuit. You know, I just went on their website. Almost the same thing. Just people looking for a crew to do double handed races. Did a couple of bit of that, and then one year I did a mini fastnet. I think it must have been 2013, I'd say, with an elderly fella who actually had worked for the Lennon before. Well, we got on fairly well. He'd done it when he was younger, and it was kind of his retirement gift to himself to kind of go back and one last season. But it was too hard for him, and he kind of, by the end of it, he just said, "Here, look, Tom, if you want, you're sound and you're good at fixing things, you know, look, I lend you the boat for a season." And so he lent me the boat, and I was working at the same time and racing, so that was a bit tricky. So that was in 2015. I had to kind of decide if I was going to go and do the mini transat or keep working. So I quit the job in Glen Ullin and kind of went off on my own. What the good thing was work almost straight away, either doing boat deliveries or fixing the work, doing a bit of shore work on the Figaro class for a lad who was sailing on the Figaro then. And so I was kind of doing odd jobs on the side, and that gave me the freedom to do the mini racing. On what was an older boat, it was a Pogo 2 actually, they were just about becoming obsolete. And the objective then, the aim of all that really was just to see if I liked it, you know. I liked the single-handed sailing stuff. Not really to know, was I good at it, just to know, did I like it and was it for me? Because my father passed away a few years before that, and I knew the inheritance was going to come. So I kind of knew a choice was coming, that I could either, you know, do something smart, like, you know, go back to college or invest in a house or just buy a brand new mini. So guess which one I did.
Yeah, I was going to say, so many times I'd have these interviews and people are, and then I had a choice between going back to college, going to university, or going all in on sailing. And of course, 9 times out of 10, I don't think I'd be interviewing them if it was I went back to college. So.
It wasn't even a choice, to be honest. I didn't say that.
you must be quite an independent person, that was kind of self-starter, I guess you would call it.
Yeah, people say that to me, actually. Yeah, I must be. I just said never. I don't know. I suppose I never had anything to lose, really. I didn't have much family pressure, I suppose, to you know, get one a classical job. I didn't have, you know, just always kind of went from one thing fell into another. Until probably about that, the first race I did with that new boat that I won. I won the first 2 races of that season. And that was the first time I realized that I might actually be, you know, I'll be too bad at this racing crack.
Let's go back to that first mini transat, though. You did that in the old boat. What was that experience like?
It was interesting. It was the longest I ever spent at sea on my own, 18 days. I remember it was when we had to go really far south for some reason, probably to do with the weather. And I had all sorts of problems. And no energy on board. You know, all the things you do in your first mini transat, you know, no windex, no wind mode in the autopilot, you know, in the trade winds where the wind shifts about 15 degrees every 10 minutes. And then remember the amount of sargass seaweed we had was horrible. And I'd a spare rudder. The Pogo 2s had rudder problems. So I had a spare rudder, and in the rudders I'd left, you know, it was like 2 bolts going through it. And I'd left them extra long so that they'd be easy to get off, and I wouldn't drop them in the water if I have to change the rudder. So I didn't think of the seaweed. So I remember trying to get all the seaweed off the rudders with my hands and cutting my arms like that on the
That is an amazing class. It's kind of pure adventure, isn't it? As much as racing.
Oh, it was brilliant. It's brilliant. And I knew I loved it, and I said, right, I wanted to come back and do it well, you know, try and see if I was any good at it. Then I did. Then I did 2 seasons of actual competitive racing, I suppose you could say. And a Pogo 3, it was called. It was just the first year that they were coming in. There was about 10 or 12 of us that were fairly good, sort of, and all the boats were more or less the same. So it was almost like one design racing for those 2 seasons. And then I started getting sponsorship, and then I started really making it becoming a career, I suppose.
Other than the fact you were racing a new boat, what else was different about the campaign? Do you have more people involved with you, more support?
I was accepted into a training group in Lorient, of where the best group boats were. So we'd even train during the week. You know, a lot of the other ones were professional, you know, like it was the first time I'd ever done actual group training, you know, for an Olympic preparation or anything, where we do speed tests, we do race, and we'd work on sails. So that was fascinating. Really, I really enjoyed that. And then I was still working on the side and I used to do some coaching. And I met a guy called Jerry Jones, who I'd known from the Glen On, actually, who had been in the Glen Ons. And I remember I did a week's coaching with him the week before I went and won that first race. So he was probably the only person that followed that race, you know. And then at the end, he was like, geez, Tom, you know, you need to keep at this. You know, you could win the Mini Trans and stuff like that. No Irish person's ever done it and all that. If you want, I can give you a hand. Look on the business part of things, because you don't seem very good at that.
That's a real consideration, though, isn't it? The thing about being a solo sailor can be that you've got to do everything. It's like the ultimate entrepreneur role.
Yeah. I remember I even made my own website, took weeks doing it. Thing that looked, it was a horrible looking thing.
He made a big difference then, that relationship.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. And then through someone he knew, so an introduction. It's fine with the whole sponsorship thing, it always seems to come down to one thing, is introductions and relations, so relationships. So he got me into an interview with a Smurfit Kappa in Dublin. That would have been the year that I'd won that first race. I was really living the dream then. You know, it wasn't a big amount, but it's the first time I actually sticking a logo on the sail. It was kind of, you know, what I was thinking, made me think back to the Volvo Ocean race days, you know, and you see all those telephonic and all these things. You're like, whoa, jeez.
Talk a bit about that company, because that's a very Irish company. It's originally was a family business, I'm sure. I remember that in the sailing that I've done in Ireland, there was quite a strong presence from that company around in terms of sponsoring regattas.
Yeah, well, they're even more than a company now. They're a group, an international group. So now they've now become recently the biggest manufacturer of paper-based cardboard in the world. So they merged with a big American group. So the biggest manufacturer of cardboard. Started off making cardboard boxes in a city in Dublin, and now they make all sort of paper-based packaging to all around the world, really. And one of their biggest markets at the time, still is, but at the time was France. So that was the real key thing. I suppose that was the other with Kingspan as well. The two companies, the idea was that they were Irish. So I suppose they knew me, or they trusted me, and they wanted to sell and communicate in France.
That's the trick, isn't it? It's not enough just to, well, I want to go and win this regatta. I want to sail around the world. I want to go to the Olympics. You have to find something in what they're doing that you can align yourself with.
Yeah. And you give them content. You know, is it danger? But what has really helped sailing recently, especially we see with the Vendée Globe, is the social media and the internet. Because, I mean, as I said, when I was small, like once a week in black and white in Irish, I could watch the Volvo Ocean race. Now, if I want to enter it offshore sailing, I just click, you know, I throw it into Google, which is probably one of the big reasons I'd say that the sport has exploded so much. It gives companies great ways to get their message out there, or to make nice images and content online that they can share. And the other, of course, all the events. The big thing the French know how to do is events around these races. Like, you bring them to the start of the Solitaire de Figaro, or even the start of the Mini Transat back then, or the Route de Rome. You know, there's these big, huge, massive events with like over millions of people. It's crazy, actually, the whole sailing world over here.
Hi everybody, Justin Chisholm here with a quick message. We do hope you're enjoying this episode of the Yacht Racing Life podcast. And we wanted you to know that you can get more great content from around the world of sailboat racing on the Yacht Racing Life website, where there's plenty of free content to check out, and premium subscribers get all areas access to the site. Head over to yachtracinglife.com/YRL pod for a lifetime 50% off the regular monthly premium subscription price. So back to the minis, what was the peak? What was the highlight of that time you spent in the minis?
It was probably the first year, actually, because I was really on form and I didn't put myself under any pressure to perform, you know, I was just enjoying it. And in the second year, once I started getting the sponsors, and I think I definitely badly managed then in the early days, the pressure to perform. I put myself under huge pressure, burnt myself out, to be honest. But then we got to the start of the mini, I was exhausted, completely worn out. Just trying to get the boat perfect. I was obsessed with the boat being perfect, and I completely forgotten about the skipper. I was disappointed. I came fifth overall, I think, or sixth. So I was quite disappointed, you know, I wanted to win it.
That's still not a bad result, huh?
No, it wasn't a bad result. No, none at all. on the old.
Tell us a bit about racing those minis, because the I've stood on a mini and I'm 6 foot two, and I think you're quite a tall guy as well.
Yeah, I'm 6 foot two.
There's not a lot of room.
No.
There's not a lot of room on deck. There's certainly not a lot of room down below.
No, it is. They're very small, right? They are very small. I suppose what's interesting about them is they're light and fast. So in a weird way, it's kind of like dinghy racing, offshore dinghy racing, you could say. You know, they're very sensitive to how you helm, or they're very sensitive to little differences in wind speed, like all light boats, I suppose, which makes the... And you've actually quite a big sail selection. You know, you've three spinnakers and a furling head sail, you know, plus a reef of a jib. You can take, I don't know how many reefs in the mainsail. So there's lots and lots of little sail choices. And the sail maneuvers are easy because the boat's so small. So it's quite interesting. Oh, especially back when I was doing it, what was fascinating was that the boats were nearly all the same. The pogo trees were almost all the same. So it was almost like one design racing. It's changed a little bit now, I think. And then there's, of course, the prototype team. I raced in the series production class, so that the boats that were more or less a bit of a box rule, whereas the prototypes, you can kind of do what you want. And they definitely were definitely fun. They've raced a bit of prototypes since. Definitely a great class to get into. Definitely, I'd say a great class to get into for people who want to try it out and see are they going any good at it. And a class in which you can progress. You know, it's not that easy to, people kind of, I think the word mini does it disfavor, because people think mini, oh, that's small, that must be easy.
What's the key to winning races in that? Is it just knowing when to, this phrase, knowing when to push, when to back off? Is it navigation? Is it, you know, what is it?
In the mini?
Yeah.
In general, in the mini, what I would say, well, it's probably a bit different to figure out. In the mini, what you can really get a lot out of is the navigation and the weather. Having a little extra on knowing a little bit more about the navigation and the weather, because I think when a lot of people go into the class, they quickly get kind of overwhelmed by the boat and the bowsprit, and they kind of get a what sail do you put up when and blah, blah, blah. So I think definitely I would say navigation, weather, and then of course sail choice, putting the right sail up.
But you're limited, aren't you? What you've got available to you in terms of tools for navigation?
Yes,
on the menu.
Exactly. Yes.
So what have you got?
A paper chart and a GPS with just Latin long written on it.
So you know where you are, but you can't. Do you have any? You don't have any weather information.
No, on the mini Transat, yeah, they transmit you a kind of zone weather forecasting. But during the other races during the season, no, you have nothing. Just the VHF, whatever the coastal reports are, the coastal forecasts are. If you've well prepared, usually you have it all prepared beforehand. I think if you have it well prepared and you have it clear in your own head. Yeah, I think there's definitely a bonus to be had, because what a lot of people do is they put the weather to one side and everyone has routers, you know, they have a group, will have a router, you know, someone, I do it a bit, you know, will be sitting on a computer, prepare the weather for them. And they just read it like basically getting on the boat. So I think, yeah, they probably don't have it that well in their head. So I'd say definitely if you have it well in your own head before going, you definitely have a plus. And the nav as well, being able to go in and rock up just by looking where, you know, being good at, you know, linking a chart and the land. Do you know what I mean? Good idea.
It's a fascinating class. It really is. And I'm glad to hear you recommending it. But you made the move out of that class and straight into the Figaro, or was there something else?
Yeah, you see, there was an opportunity because it was the last year of the Figaro 2, 2018. So there was an opportunity to actually get in and do the Figaro cheaply. The boat was actually cost half the price. The Figaro 2 was actually cost half the price of the mini. You know, I think they were going at the end, they were like going for like €35,000, I think. Some of them even 30s, because people were afraid that they just want to get rid of them because there was a new Figaro 3 coming in. There wasn't that much of a little jump in the budget to ask the sponsors for, you know. And then it was kind of like, I saw it as my chance to do the Figaro, you know, kind of now or never kind of thing, you know. Which had been the figure, to be honest, it's probably one of the class that had made me dream the most. Because just the idea of all the boats being identical, of the fact that it's a race on time. And the way the four legs, back then it was four legs, like one leg after another. I thought that was like crazy. But I used to think that was, geez, how do people do that? You know?
Yeah, it's like running marathons day after day, right? That's how I always look at it. And what's the gap in between legs?
It depends how long the leg is, because the leg, if the leg... Like last year, we did the longest leg in history. Was it last year? It was like 5 days. But the start is always on a Sunday. So if that means we left on a Sunday, we got in on like a Thursday to Friday, only like a 48 hour turnover. So the longer the leg is, the shorter the rest is.
So the start times are fixed. So if you have a good leg, you've got an advantage.
Definitely.
We'll get on to that race itself, but let's talk a bit about that Figaro 2, and then I want to talk about the Figaro 3 class. So you're saying it's a one design boat, but just for those people who may be listening outside of Europe, just talk about that boat a bit.
Well, it's a class. The whole thing, the solitary Figaro itself started in 55 years ago. The idea was, I think that they kind of modeled it on the Tour de France cyclist, if they wanted to make a race, because, you know, sailboat racing is a bit complicated with like the IRC system and all these, you know, different calculations you have to do. So they said, right, why don't we make it something simple where there's all the same boats and whoever does the course in the shortest time wins. And we'll send a journalist out at sea and broadcast the thing on land. So they actually did that. They actually had journalists and, you know, typing at sea and send it in the paper, or whoever has done this or whoever's winning. But started back 55 years ago. And then I think probably because all the boats were the same, got very, very competitive. And then probably in the beginning, the early 90s, it became more and more professional. Now it's almost fully professional. And then they updated the boat a few times. So they had a Figaro 1, which was from 1990 until about 2004, I think. And then the Figaro 2 was from 2004 until 2019. And then now we're on the third evolution of the boat, which is the Figaro 3, which has foils, which is one design boat with foils. All about 30 foot, in and around 30 foot. The Figaro 2 is a bit bigger, as a 35 foot. And the idea is that this is the skipper that makes a difference.
Always a Beneteau built boat.
Always Beneteau.
Yeah, that's fantastic for them, I guess, because it's purpose-built market for their new boats.
It's actually a fairly practical, like each time they made an offer, like they made a, what you call it, you could different boat yards could actually offer it, but because it's a one design fleet, they had to change the boats for everyone at once. So Beneteau were the only ones that were able to build 50 of them and put them sitting in a car park. And then basically changed the whole fleet in one go. So that was the big reason for Beneteau, and that was it twice. And they became a partner of the class and things like that.
And I seem to remember when they made that change from the Beneteau 2 to the Beneteau 3, they were very smart about the way they tried to equalize time people had in the boats. There was a kind of a draw system for getting them. Can you just explain that?
Yeah, we pulled numbers out of a hat. And you got it. We all went to the Paris Boat Show and got like a little ball with a number in it, and that was your number. I got number 8. That was just to make sure that no one could go, and because we're all sitting in a car park, you know, just to make sure they're not one of the big teams, because some teams are ordered 2 or 3 of the boats, you know, so that they couldn't go down and measure absolutely everything and weigh them, and you say like, oh, we want this one. That's the do it out of that, which is a good way of doing it.
Yeah, made it very well, made it as fair as possible, yeah. I guess at that, but I thought that was just a very innovative
It was fascinating.
Way of doing things.
It was so fascinating that the first months of the Figaro 3, because everyone, all the old rock stars came back and ordered one. And everyone was such a rush to get the boats onto the water to train as quickly as we could, because the Figaro was in June, actually, it was early. And everyone was trying to discover this new boat, you know, with the foils, where do we set them, and develop sails at the same time. So the debriefs in our training groups were mad. You had all these like rock stars sitting there arguing or debating or debriefing them. A day sailing was always his time actually to be there.
That's intimidating though, isn't it? Because I remember like Charles Caudrelier was in there, and didn't Mitch Dez go back in at some point?
Yeah. I remember in our group we had Loïc Perron, Pascal Bidegory. I think Charles could have been there. He was kind of floating in around places. And then I remember sailing with Damien Foxhall, and then there was Morgan. I think I opened my mouth once, I'd say. But it was mad to see them all arguing with each other. We're not arguing, but, you know, like slagging each other and going, oh, no, that's what you do. So it was fascinating. I learned so much.
Yeah, I was going to say, it must have been a massive learning opportunity just to be around these people and see. Yeah. I mean, it's that professional attitude, it's that professional way of doing things that you can learn, right?
Yeah. And they'd be like, I remember on the Armour we used to do this. And they'd be like, oh yeah, that's true. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. And then on the mods, this. And then yeah, I see all those old stories. And then you've done a couple of races, you might beat them or something. And you'd be like, ah, Jesus.
That's the beauty of one design.
Yeah.
So that first race for you in the older design, how did that go?
What's a baptism of fire, you could say. Because yeah. it was some change from the Mini, which, as I said, was a light kind of planing, you know, asymmetric boat with like a lot of sail choices and things like that, to the Figaro 2, which was by that stage was quite heavy and slow, and had a symmetric spinnaker. So I'd done a bit, like, but I had to go back and figure out how to jibe on my own and with a symmetric spinnaker. And then the other thing was they'd been the fleet had been so, like, they'd been racing these things for 15 years. They had every sail setting down to the minimum, you know, they knew exactly what to do. And so I was just this little rookie trying to figure out how to make the thing move. So it was tough enough the first year, actually. But I remember I did good leg. It was tough enough, but I could feel that there was potential, if you know what I mean. I think I did a leg, I finished sixth or seventh in the leg of the Figaro's. And unfortunately, I had to abandon, I had to give up the first leg. That was a killer because the spreader bracket broke. Which meant the other thing with Figaro is the time punishment. You have absolutely no margin for error. You're not allowed. If you give up a leg, if you abandon a leg, you get the time of the last boat plus 2 hours. So we had the last boat was 12 hours and it was 12 hours behind. So I had a 14-hour penalty after the first leg. So it was more or less over. But again, I didn't manage myself right, really.
Let's move on to the Figaro 3. Talk us through that boat because that's a very familiar sight now. Around Europe.
Yeah. So it was like a big Mini, really, because we went back asymmetric spinnakers, more or less the same sail setup. And then the foils, everyone remember the big question was like, will the foils work? You know, will they do anything or do we have to take them off and all these things? And then we very quickly realized it was quite a fun boat and quite interesting from a strategical point of view because there were, you know, bigger angles, especially downwind. And it was much, much more sensitive to wind differences and wind speeds compared to the Figaro 2. You know, the Figaro 2 would more or less always plod along between, you know, 8 and 9 knots. And, you know, you could have a little, you know, it wouldn't really make that. The angle, you'd sail really low, the angle wouldn't change much. So strategically, everyone used to just kind of sail around in a big bunch. Whereas the Figaro 3, you could definitely be a bit more aggressive in your angles and in your strategy. And at the helm, because if you could get the boat to start to lift the foil and start to plane, but more or less plane and foil, I suppose, you know, it won't fly. You could very quickly make very big differences. And the first year, the sails, no one was kind of a different sail makers are kind of, you know, doing what they thought was best. So there was huge differences in the sail design, which meant in different conditions, certain boats would take off and certain ones wouldn't. So that was quite interesting.
One design boat, but not one design sails. Am I reading that right?
No, they're not one design, the sails. There's a class rules that have maximum for the spinnaker, it's SPL, maximum girth and things like that for each sail. But so we can more or less play with the shape, where we put the volume, you know, the roach size is more or less, you know, everything. There's a maximum in for everything. And then, yeah, we can more or less fiddle with the volume, fiddle with battens, things like that. So the first year, there was huge differences. In boat speed, so it was quite fun. Now they've all more or less joined into one, which is what happened in the Figaro 2. They're all more or less the same thing, you know. Which means right. it's a bit less extreme, the differences now.
Is there a dominant sailmaker in that class now?
More or less two, yeah. More or less Alcidos and Norse.
Okay.
Because the other thing they did is change the class rules is they allowed for molded sails, which weren't allowed before.
So how did you set about learning how to sail this very different boat? I mean, you said it's a little bit like the Mini, but it's quite different to what you sailed before.
Well, lots and lots of training, I suppose, and lots of racing. And then I had a lot of help. I suppose I sailed with Damien a bit the first year. And then I had another French skipper kind of took me under his wing called Gilles de Maille, who had been quite dominant in the Figaro 2 before. And fairly quickly quite dominant. He came second the first year in 2019. So we worked a lot together. We have kind of training groups. So I was in Lorient for a long time where there was a group of 10 or 12 boats. And then we quite often have a sparring partner. So maybe another boat or two, maybe maximum three, where you might work together on very, very precise things like sail design or certain sail settings or foil settings or mast rake and things like that. And then you work together, you sit down, you brief, debrief. And you'll add a lot of experience on how on strategy, on tactics, on how to race, to figure out stuff. And I was fairly good at boat speed wise. So we were fairly complimentary there. So we did a lot of work together, and I think that kind of, I had a tough year. 2019 was a bad, I didn't have a great figure because, well, I had a good leg or two, but I had a bad year because I was, again, mismanaging myself. 2021 wasn't great either, but I forget the years. No, 2020 then was a big one when I finished fifth. And that was, that at the time was the best result any. One of the best results ever from a non-French skipper, I think. A best ever Irish result. And then I think so. It's just started getting better and better in my head, really. Managing the ups and downs of offshore racing at that level, you know.
Yeah.
Which was a big, 2020 was a big thing. Because then I started, that's the first time I actually said, geez, I can win this, you know. I felt this in me that I was capable. At least I had the tools to win it.
Were you at that stage just focused on the Figaro? Were you doing any other sailing?
No, 2019, I hadn't yet Kingspan. So yeah, I was doing other sailing. For 2019 and 20, I was doing other sailing on the side, yeah. I did a bit of IRC stuff. Some mini stuff as well, some coaching and things on mini, and then some weather routing and things like that. So yeah, I was working on the side. And then 2020, when I finished fifth Kingspan, that was when Kingspan kind of noticed and came on board and kept me to kind of, the capability of felt right about saying, hey, look, I can win this thing if you want.
We should talk about the race itself. It's quite an unusual race. It's very French.
Yeah.
As you say, it's been going for 55 years. In general terms, just explain for people who don't know it, perhaps who are listening outside of Europe, what's the race all about?
So as I said, it's whoever does the race course in the shortest time. Over three or four legs, and they're never the same legs. So for example, the last 2 years have been three long legs of between 600 and 700 miles, usually leaving from a port in France somewhere. We'd have always a little short inshore race, like a windward leeward, or maybe there's usually a little kind of spectacle thing that they bring us back around in front of the port, because that way people can see us sailing by. And then we sail offshore for 600 or 700 miles. So usually about 4 days. To another port, usually a foreign one. This year we went to Spain. Now we rest, we get off the boat. You have a shore team who'll come and manage the boat and get everything tidied up. We go and try and rest and recuperate as much as we can, prepare the weather for the next leg. It's the same thing, short inshore race and then off for 600 or 700 miles, quite often around the Fastnet, Wolf Rock. We're up to the Isle of Man 1 year, or even around Cap Finisterre one time. So another 600-700 miles into the next port, and then you start to start to feel the fatigue then, because you've done two races more or less, and then same again. So try and rest and recuperate, and back off again for another 600 or 700 miles. And whoever does it in the shortest time wins. So the all time record after four legs would have been, when it was four shorter legs, was 13 seconds after a month of race.
Wow.
This year I won it by 25 minutes, which is quite a big one, actually, which is quite a big, for as Figaro's score, it was a big difference.
When you finish those legs, you just talked about the fatigue elements of it, which obviously builds up over the period of the race.
Yeah.
What's the protocol there? Because do you want to just go and get like two or three nights really good sleep, or do you want to stay in your cat napping offshore sailing kind of mode?
It's interesting because it's something this year, it was a huge difference this year. It's something we worked on a lot, was the recovering during legs. So you're right in that you have to keep, the best thing is to keep your sleep phasic. So you have to make sure that the golden rule is you get in more or less and then you go to sleep for as long as you can. Usually it's like you sleep for about 12 hours straight. And then you have to make sure you get up. And then nutrition is a very important part of it, because you know, we've been offshore for 4 days. Eating not very healthy food. So make sure you have plenty of fruit, vegetables, avoid fat. You know, the, as you said, the tempting thing is to go out and drink three beers and have a big steak and load of chips. But no, if they keep make sure that nutrition that we have during the year is quality, and we're getting everything that you missed, you know, plenty of protein or carbohydrates, sorry, before the second start, and then fruit and veg as much as you can. And then, which is very important, is to sleep, have a nap in the afternoon as long as you can, and then get up, and then you're already into weather routing for the next leg. You always have interviews and things like that, and you have to kind of check that the boat's all right, like the shore crew will be working on the boat. And then exercise is very important. So we have physiotherapists that come and, you know, help us, you know, get all the aches and pains out. And then it's important just to go out and do some light cardio work, just so that because you build up all these toxins and stuff in your muscles from not sleeping well, just to get out and sweat a bit if you can, without injuring yourself, of course. And then back in and try and just sleep as long as you can. And we really went this year, we kind of went, right, how can we maximize the recuperation between the legs? So what we did is every stopover, we made sure when we were reserving the apartment that there was, you know, blinds that completely closed down. I had, like, you know, as you would an airplane, things that would cover my eyes. I had earplugs in case. Well, first of all, we made sure that we weren't in the town center, so there'd be no pubs or anything around. I even bought a pillow and slept with the pillow in my bed with my fiance for a week or two before the race, so that the pillow would smell like home. So that, you know, when I get into the pillow, I think that, you know, we went really as far out as you could with the thing, just to make sure that the recovery during the legs was so optimized that the weather, when I could analyze the weather, it would be clear in my head and then I'd do well.
It's been worth doing this podcast interview just for the pillow story, I've got to say. That's tremendous. So let's talk about this last race. It was your seventh edition of the race, and you ended up winning and becoming the first non-Frenchman since, what was it? It's a long time. 1988, Laurent Bourgnon.
Yeah, it was Swiss.
And not only the third non-French person ever to win the race.
Yeah.
So it's a huge, huge achievement.
Yeah, no, I'm delighted. Still pinching myself.
Are you interested in advertising your product or service on the Yacht Racing Life podcast? It's really simple. Go to yachtracinglife.com/advertising to find out how. When you went into that race, I'm sure you went into it trying to win it. You said a couple of times you felt that you had the ability to win this race, and the confidence and knowing that we all know in competitive sport it's very important to believe that you can do stuff. But how much did you expect to win that race?
I don't know if I expected to win it. I knew I see the last 2 years, like the 2022, I came very close to it as well, to a podium at least. Tom LaPerce was dominant that year. But I messed up the last leg, one bad decision on the last leg, and it cost me a lot of time. So I finished seventh. The thing is, if you look at the results, I mean, and then last year I finished 17th. You know, when you look at the results, it was 17th. But I mean, it was just because of one transition in the Bay of Bristol where I lost 15 hours, you know. So the 2 years leading up to it, I'd more or less come within one, either transition or wind shift or bad decision of either a podium or winning. So I knew I wasn't far off. And then I started working with a sports psychologist a lot this year and last year a little bit. And the way we worked on it was that we really stopped focusing on the result. If you know what I mean? We don't work on objectives. Like, we don't sit down and say, right, we want to win. The objective is to win this, to figure out. We really try to concentrate on all the little things that we can control. You know, rather than thinking of the final destination, think of all the little bits along the way. So, as I said, the recovery during the legs, the boat has to be perfect. Anyway, in this race, I already knew you can't break. You know, you're not allowed to have damage that stops you, because otherwise you lose time and you lose the race. So the boat had to be perfect. My physical preparation had to be completely perfect. You know, we had to control all the nutrition during the race, the short team, the team around us. And once you get all of those things lined up, is that you really start enjoying it again. because you take away that pressure of I want to win, which means that when something goes wrong at sea, you're not thinking, oh, I'm not going to win. You're just thinking, okay, it's not bad. There's no problem. What do I do now? I just control what I can control now, which is boat speed, sea speed. And then, so I suppose the objective, it was the first time I've ever not had an objective. And I just said, the objective is to go out and have fun. That was really the thing. I'll go out and enjoy it. The result would be what it is. Control all the controllables, enjoy it. And the result would be what it is. Because it's funny, because I used to always, when you'd hear people saying, you know, journalists always ask you, what's your objective? And you'd be like, off. No one wants to say, I want to win, you know. And people would always go, I'd always see people saying, oh, I want to go, just go out there and have fun. I used to think, oh, it's just a way of avoiding the question, you know. And I was listening to more and more during the Paris Olympics this year, a lot more and more athletes saying, yeah, I just want to go out there and have fun. And it's probably the truest thing that's ever happened to me, I think. Because for so long, I was putting myself under so much pressure. If something would go wrong at sea, you know, I'd be the wrong side of a wind shift. I'd be thinking, oh, I'm going to be last. And then, you know, the sponsors aren't going to be happy. And then I'm going to have to, the banker are going to come and seize the boat. And then I'm going to pay for them. I'm going to lose my house. And, you know, all this spiral of bad thoughts.
Sports psychology is very common in other mainstream sports. It's, I think, maybe at an Olympic level, we see it. I haven't heard about it that much with offshore sailing. Some of the Volvo teams have done some kind of specialist coaching in that area, but it strikes me as, you know, your story is a great example of just how potent that can be.
Yeah, absolutely. And to be honest, Figaro is considered here, at least as Olympic level. You know, it's a department of sport, have different levels of you know, what am I trying to say, that you have like a status, you know, and the called a high performance athlete. You know, it's the same for all sports. And there's a different level of it. And one is Olympic medal. The winning the solitaire figure was more or less the same. And the Vendée Globe, you know, it's all kind of a different level. So once you kind of accepted that, you kind of, the whole project is run as an Olympic campaign would be, you know. And the other thing is, you see more and more of it, first of all, in the solitaire figure, because we have absolutely no outside contact. So if something goes wrong, we can't ring a coach, or, you know, we can't have a substitution, or you can't, something breaks, you have to fix it. So you have to have all this toolkit inbuilt to say, right, if something goes wrong, I need a little process set up and in place to deal with whatever problem I have. So I think, yeah, more and more in the Vendée Globe now, they all have more and more, especially the lead boats, definitely all have sports psychologists. They're not allowed to contact them during the race, but they definitely would have a bulletproof toolkit to deal with.
So let's talk about the race itself. Talk us through the course, first of all, specifically for that race.
So it was from Le Havre, more or less, down the south coast of the UK, around Wolf Rock, and then down to Gijón in the north of Spain. That was a leg, as always in the English Channel, with strong tides. The start was very important, because usually, you know, the tidal shift comes from the west, so the further west you are, the further you extend. So I knew, basically looking at that, and then the other big thing was arriving in Spain. Have you ever sailed in the north coast of Spain? The wind is always either east, west, or zero, you know, because it's a big, huge mountain range. I can't remember what it's called. But, you know, once the wind is anyway north or south, it's completely, it's an absolute standstill, which means you can lose a lot of time. Legs have been won and lost in the north coast of Spain, because one or two boats will get through and then the wind will shut down and the rest of the fleet will be stuck there for 12 hours, and that's the end of it. So leaving for that leg, I really had two things in mind: was have a good start to be in the packet leaving the English Channel, and then the second one was to absolutely calm strategy wise while arriving in Spain, because it was definitely a moment not to win the solitaire Figaro, but you could definitely lose it. So it was just and I think it's exactly what happened. We all arrived in about 10 minutes, I think 20 boats in 10 minutes. That was the aim for that one, and that worked.
That was a ninth position for you in that leg, if I'm right.
Yeah. 1:30 from the winner.
So when it's time based, it really changes things, doesn't it? Because a 9-point gap to first and a so many seconds gap to first is a very different kettle of fish, isn't it? So the big picture risk versus reward decisions you're making are quite different to if you're just normal fleet racing.
You sail off on your own into one corner, you know, you're taking a big risk, you know, you can lose a lot of time. Well, you know, it's all about priorities, really. We've a system we use called, you know, a different pile of priorities to manage strategy at sea and decision making. And competitors is one of the big factors in it, and might often a very important one.
Right. Well, yeah, I'm sure. So then leg two was a leg that you won. And this, to me, this is when I kind of tuned into your campaign this time around, was when you won that leg. And you came back with a 57-minute lead on the next boat at the end of that, which is kind of huge, isn't it?
I think, as I said, the recovery was a big, huge part of it. Because I'm more or less, another thing I did this year was I isolated myself. So for the stopovers, I did that whole sleep thing, as I said to you, and I actually stayed on my own, more or less. The only contact I had was my shore crew. It was Gilda, actually, the guy I was telling you about earlier. So he was like a coach in the shore crew. So I actually stayed on my own, my little bubble, recovered really well. And the morning of the start, as I said, the north coast of Spain, big load of mountains, and it was a cold front coming from the northwest. And basically, the idea was to go out and sail and get across that cold front as quickly as we could. And I remember the morning of the start, I looked at the synoptic chart, and I just kind of noticed that it was a little bit different. You know, there was a little, the gradient, the lines in the synoptic chart seemed to be coming a little bit in from the further from the west rather than the northwest. And I just remember this moment of lucidity, and I kind of said, yeah, I know we're going to have to get to the front, but I think, first of all, we're going to have to get west. And then we left with a bit of a sloppy start, and there was a sea breeze that none of the grid files or no one had seen. So we all were sending downwind westerly, which get another reason, which kind of said, another reason to go west. Because the synoptic, you know, when the sea breeze dies, is going to come in from the west. So that were two big reasons in my head to go west. And the rest of the fleet had stuck to the original plan that had been what had been shown for the last few days, which was to sail northwest. And then I suppose they all kind of, as you said, didn't want to take too much risk and an ass. So I saw all my competitors kind of more or less sailing high, as you could tell, up to the northwest. And I kind of just put a really, really low, slow mode to get west. And then the wind just came in. The further west we were, the more wind we had, which meant I passed the front ahead of the rest of them. And I was always, when I passed it, I was further west anyway. So by the time it came into them, I was already I remember one stage I was at like 18 knots, you know. On starboard, I tacked and I was like at 18 knots, and I looked at the DIS and some of them were doing like half a knot. Then the next morning, I couldn't see anyone. I said, oh, no. I was like, whoa, okay. And then the rest of the race, I was just ahead.
So that was one transition that you got right, but you kind of broke your rule, right? You split from the pack.
Yeah, but that's not my routine. It's probably my good thing. The thing that I was bad at the start was I taking too much risks. But now I think I really have managed to realize the moment when you should do your own thing and stop following the fleet. Kind of realize when now the fleet are all being sheep, they're all following each other, but the weather is that way. I think that's kind of become my little strong point. And then I just felt it. You know, I don't know. You just feel it. Like you're like, no, it's in the west, and you could see the clouds coming. You know, a bright blue sky, and then you could see the front. You know. And then a funny story about that, the whole thing really came to comeuppance because I finished, as I said, even at night time I couldn't see them. The last night, like, I had the rankings because there's basically a television boat comes up and films you. So when they're beside you, it's a good sign because you're first. And I couldn't see anyone. I was like, geez, okay. So arriving Royan, which is the big huge river more or less with a lighthouse in the middle of it, and we were against the tide. So that's the only thing that could have scuppered me, was because I was coming in ahead of the tide and they were on a run with the tide. And they ran aground trying to stay away from, you know, staying hiding from the tide. It's a sandbank and it moves all over the place, you know. So I was basically standing in the cockpit ready to jibe because I knew I was, you know, there was a contour line coming up. And I just felt the boat go. And then, and I just managed to jibe and kind of broach out the other way. And luckily it came off because the tide was falling.
Wow, I didn't realize that. That's amazing. Whoa. Was the camera boat next to you when you did that?
Yeah, no, yeah, it was. No, he'd gone back to get the rest of the fleet because there was a whole armada of helicopters and boats coming out to welcome me, you know, and they film it. They film it live. So I could see them coming. I was like, oh my God. Imagine. It would have been funny. Well, not really.
That's almost an Alex Thompson moment, huh?
Yeah. Geez, the stories we don't really tell.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thanks for sharing it on here. So that set you up for leg three. And for me, that must have been agonizing because now you're the favorite. You have a 57-minute lead on everybody. That's like my worst nightmare, is being oh, you got it in the bag. Was the psychology in play with the other competitors?
Well, the last leg was weird because, you know, I had an hour head start on the second, an hour and a half on the third, which is huge in the Figaro. So I had to do was manage the distance between me and the dude who was second. You know, all the other boats weren't important anymore. And we were sailing from Royan, which is around Bordeaux, you know, it's in the southwest of France, up into around the end of Brittany, down to a buoy off Portland Bill in the English Channel, and then back to more or less the same place, La Tourbalet, not far from it. And in the English Channel, we were going to guess, it was forecasting, and what we got was like 30, 35 knots, 30, probably gusting 38, downwind under a small spinnaker. So the way I was going to lose the Figaro was if I broke something, more or less. It was like 6-7 hours driving in, you know, 30, 35 knots of wind, a jibe in 35 knots of wind, which none of us had ever done. And then I drop. I had to get that done and still be winning an hour, your man. And an hour at the end, because the last bit from once we got back in Brittany, that's probably the thing that I had in my head was 120 miles for 12, you know, for 12 hours. So I just had to be within 10 miles of him by the end of it. That's all I could be behind him. Once I was in 10 miles, it was grand.
That's 700 miles of opportunity for things to go wrong, for
stuff
to run into, for, yeah, I mean, just massive pressure.
And he was like,
I guess this is when all of the preparation and stuff really starts to pay at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially in the strong wind, because he was, he could see him in the AS. He was about 3 or 4 miles ahead of me, which was acceptable, you know. I remember thinking, right, this is hairy, you know, I'm gonna chicken jive, you know. It was like 35 knots of wind, you know, established or whatever, you know, flat. And the wind kept lifting. So the starboard ley line and what I was going to have to do on starboard kept getting bigger and bigger, you know, and it was going to be like 10, 11 miles, which is 1 hour. And I said, geez, 1 hour, if I'm at like 8 knots instead of 15, you know, so I said, right, gonna have to, and I could see there was a whole fleet was behind me kind of thing. So I managed to jibe and said, right, they're all going to chicken jibe, and then turn around. And once they seen me jibing, everyone started jibing, while there's all cups went wrong. So I was fairly hairy, though. Jesus.
How do you jibe a Figaro 3 in that much wind? And what was the sea state like as well?
It was fairly lumpy, actually. Sea state, it could have been worse, but it was fairly lumpy because I think it was wind against tide as well. We were under a small spinnaker with one reef in the mainsail. So I suppose what you do is you just kind of run a bit low and then you pass the kite with the winch, you know. Just mull it over and then winch, wind. And then eventually it'll just, once you get the clue past the forestay, you know, it'll just go bam and then fills itself. And then you kind of goose wing for a while, get the stack done, and then you have to, at one stage it's inevitable, you have to let off the backstay and put on the new one, and it helms. And all right, yeah. Oh, it's okay. It was good because then you take the helm, and because it's a light, fast boat, and it was a bit, the sea state probably helped as musically. You can get a surf fairly easily. Once you get the boat surfing, it's okay. The apparent wind is really less. It kind of goes okay.
But potential for disaster is pretty high, right? I mean, what's the success rate? Well, you said nobody really knew how to do it in those sort of conditions.
I'd done it in 30, but I'd never done it in 35. Which, so it's 100% success rate for me anyway, for an out touch.
Generally in 30 knots of breeze, what's the success rate on a jibe like that?
I don't know. It depends if you're under a big kite, because 30 knots is the crossover. So if you're under a big spinnaker, I don't know. I couldn't tell you. Probably not great. You end up broaching. But I suppose once you've jived, you actually broach the end of it.
Watching the videos, I was watching the highlights video of the race, and obviously the video from that leg, there's lots of shots of the boats broaching out as they're kind of hurtling downwind. And in a fully crewed boat at that point, to get the bow down, you'd maybe drop the halyard on the kite a bit and, you know, manage to bear away. What's the protocol when you're sailing single-handed in that situation?
Well, the problem we have is that you can't, because of the foils, it's extremely risky to drop to let off a bit of halyard. So if it's under big spinnaker, and it's something we realized the first year is fairly hairy, is if sometimes the boat won't come up from the pure windage of the, if it's the big kite, the boat will just stay on its side. So we all have a Martin breaker system. You probably know what a Martin breaker just releases the tack. So
that system completely releases the tack from the sail itself.
Yeah, which means the tack just flaps out and then you bear away. If you're quick, you can kind of run up and grab it and put it in. But I haven't had a bad watch like that in a long time.
But that's costly. That's, you know, that's a complete reset and relaunch. And
yeah, fatigue, a lot of energy. But no, yeah. We don't have the brooches aren't really that bad, really. It'll nearly always come up, so it's deep keel, a lot of weight in it. So.
Okay. So your closest rival is leading the race and I read somewhere you were doing, kind of losing your mind a little bit, doing the maths, doing the calculations, trying to work out. He didn't really know where he was, I don't think, in terms of distance. Just talk us through that a little bit.
No, I had to see the fellow was second. I knew where he was because I could see him. He was only by the end of it all, when the last couple of miles, he was about 2 or 3 miles ahead of me. So I knew he was okay. But I'd completely forgotten about the fellow who was third, who was an hour and a half behind me, because I kind of said, he's an hour and a half. Never. He was so far ahead, I couldn't see him on the AIS. So I was really getting nervous about him. And then about 6 or 7 miles from the finish, at one stage I kind of said, no, it's done, duck, because the wind actually died. It wasn't forecast. The wind died and we were against the tide, so I couldn't see him anymore. And I think, geez, he's definitely gone. We have to announce ourselves when we get to the finish line. And I could hear him. I heard him just, broken on the VHF. I couldn't hear him what he said, but I could just say, on the VHF, very officially kind of thing. I said, that must be him finishing the thing. So I looked and it was like 6 miles. Oh, I was like, that's okay. Like six, I know I couldn't see him, and I was like trying to calculate, how far you hear the VHF, line of sight, and what if he's healed, and all these everything you can to your head, and then turned out it was okay in the end.
Yeah. So I saw the video of you crossing the finish line, and there was a moment where you kind of put your thumbs up with a very questioning looking face. Was that the moment you realized you'd won the race?
No, not even, because they don't tell you. What they do is they film him as well. They go out and they film, if it's close like that, they film the two potential winners. So they kind of come in and they film and they go, bravo, bravo, you could say that bravo to anyone. So it was actually one of them said, yeah, it's okay. So I was like, is it okay? And they're all standing there looking at me, no one wanted to tell me.
What an amazing feeling. And what's been the reaction back in Ireland to this victory?
Fairly big in the old sailing community. I've got a lot of great messages from people in the Irish sailing community, and it's definitely a big thing. Apart from that, I was on the news and stuff, but it, honestly, as I said, sailing is just almost non-existent in Ireland.
And let's compare that with France now. Are you now a household name? People recognise you in the street?
Yeah, no, I don't know how to go that far, but yeah, I know definitely in France, there's definitely a big, huge amount of in the newspapers and stuff. I know it's like there were 200 articles or something. It was in like full spread headline in the sports sections of all the biggest newspapers, the Irish fellow won the Figaro. It's gas. I only saw this like a couple of weeks later, when people are sure we don't have a review of all the press and stuff.
So the sponsors must be delighted with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Mad.
Paid for all the 7 years in one race.
Yeah. Mad, isn't it? As I said in the thing, they sponsored a farmer from the middle of nowhere in Ireland to do the French elite offshore racing championship. Yeah. So I was more happy for them that I did the job. And I kind of, when we sat down 3 years ago and I kind of said, here, look, within 3 years, I could win it. So I kind of felt like I did the job done, more or less. It was great.
You obviously know what I'm building up to now. So what's next for Tom Dolan?
In the immediate future, I'm going to defend my title. Because I want to keep sailing. So I'm going to go back and I'll do the Figaro again one time more, at least next year.
Yeah.
And more than likely some other racing, either on the Mocha or a Class 40. I don't know yet. It's kind of musical chairs at the moment for there's a big double-handed and crude season next year. With the Ocean Race Europe, the Transat Jacques Vabre, and then a whole load of other crude and double-handed races on Class 40s and the Mocha. So I'm trying to shuffle the program to figure out what I'll do along with the Figaro. So lots and lots of sailing anyway. And then at the same time, on the side, we're working slowly towards getting a boat, buying the Mocha, and having an Irish Mocha project for the Vendée Globe and hopefully the Ocean Race as well. So that's the next objective.
That would be fantastic. Last time we had an ocean race campaign was Green Dragon, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I can't remember what age it was, but I remember that one. Yeah.
Plenty on the cards for you. It sounds like we're going to be have lots to watch from you over the next few seasons. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me today. It's been really entertaining. I could do another hour or so, but I'm kind of conscious I've got to let you get on with your life as well. I think we'll bring it to a halt here. I'm sure people will really enjoy listening to your story. And maybe we'll check in again during this season once you know exactly what you're doing and we can catch up.
Yeah, whenever you want. Thank you very much for having me.
Fantastic. Thanks, Tom.
That's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Life podcast. We will be back soon with another top name interview, but in the meantime, check out yachtracinglife.com for more great content from across the sailing world. Thank you.